Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Majedi Investments Investment Trust. We're going to be looking at the strategy and their approach to markets and how they've been dealing with recent gyrations in markets and getting insights into their outlook for the trust. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Dan Higgins, who is the Chief Investment Officer at Marylebone Partners, who is the manager of the Majedi Investments Investment Trust. Dan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into it, and this is a really interesting conversation coming up, it's a really interesting investment trust. I don't think there's anything out there that can match it in terms to the diversification and access to investments that are otherwise quite difficult to get exposure to. But before we get into it, Dan, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself, but as well as Marylebone Partners and the Majedi Investments Trust, please?
Yes. So I'm the founder and CIO of a firm called Marylebone Partners. We're based in London. We are independently owned. We've been around for about 12 years and we've been doing what we do for some time longer than that. Most of us have a background, a pedigree at blue chip firms. And we started Marylebone Partners because we are motivated by the desire to play a pivotal role in the investment success of our clients. And we think the best way of doing that is by finding them differentiated fundamental investments for absolute returns, for returns that will grow their wealth over and above the potential the effects of inflation over the long term. And up until a couple of years ago, we had done that primarily through an open-ended fund structure that for regulatory reasons was only available to what the regulator deems professional investors. So large investors like family offices, endowments, charities, ultra high net worth individuals. And it had always been part of our original plan to manage money within the investment trust format. I'd done it before in my past life and we're great believers in the format. And that became a reality when Majedi Investments, which as an entity has been around for over 100 years and has been an investment trust since the 1980s, Majedi Investments was looking for a new manager. They felt it was time for a change and that they wanted to offer their shareholders something that was really relevant and pertinent for a new world, the post-COVID world. And we were thankfully chosen as the new manager almost exactly 2 years ago.
Looking now at the investment objective in a little bit more detail, of course, you've got a very diverse portfolio, and we're actually going to discuss that in more detail as we go through the podcast. But to set things off, I know you touched on it there, but could you go into a little bit more detail about, you know, the investment objective and your dividend policy, please?
Yeah. So the formal investment objective is to deliver returns, total returns, that beat inflation by at least 4% over rolling 5-year periods. And the total return includes a dividend. And the dividend is targeted at 3% per annum, paid quarterly. So we understand the importance of income to shareholders, but the primary source of return we think over time is going to be through capital gains. And we've coined a phrase to describe the way in which we seek to do that, which is that we have a liquid endowment approach. And maybe as a starting point for the conversation, I should explain exactly what we mean by that.
So yes, please do.
So the endowment part of what we do is that we emulate the mindset and philosophy that's been so successful for the elite university endowments over many decades. And in essence, That means being very long-term, very fundamental, not investing in anything that has a low return expectation solely for its diversification benefits, being willing to seek out differentiated and sometimes alternative return sources. But unlike the university endowments, and here's the liquid bit, we don't invest in anything truly illiquid like private equity or venture capital or real estate or infrastructure, mostly because we just don't think it's necessary to tie your money up for 7 years or 10 years in order to generate superior returns. But I have to say, when we took over as a manager for Majedi, we could never have imagined how important that was going to be within the investment trust sector because of market events and what's happened to interest rates and certain asset classes. I think there's an understandable degree of skepticism amongst shareholders about some truly illiquid assets and whether they're priced realistically. And the nice thing about what we do is everything we own is marked to market at least quarterly by an independent third party. So shareholders really can have confidence that the NAV is the NAV. It's not something that we've made up.
There's three core strategies within the JD portfolio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking here, I think each one of these is going to warrant quite a detailed conversation. So as opposed to going through one by one to start with, I think it would be good if you could give us an overview of the three strategies and maybe just start with outlining the weighting to each of those, and then we can go in and unpick each one in more detail afterwards.
Yes, absolutely. So as you say, there are three core strategies. These are the three things that we as a firm do that we specialize in. I'll go through them in order of allocation size within the portfolio. So the largest of the three, which is around 60% of the total at present, we call external managers. And as the name suggests, we source and access what we believe to be amongst the world's best fundamental investors operating in structurally inefficient niche areas. So my prior career was as the CIO of a firm called Fauchier Partners. We were a very large fund of hedge funds. And as part of that network, my role previously at Mercury Asset Management, the experience of my colleagues here, we've just built an extraordinary network over the years that includes some of the world's best investors in these more niche areas who tend to operate within boutique firms. And we know where to find this talent. And we've also developed a series of tools and quantitative systems that help us identify whether their returns are a function of skill or the area that they operate in or luck. And very often these funds are very hard to find and they're hard to access. They're not open to external investors, but we can access them on behalf of our clients. So just to give you a flavor of the sort of thing that features in our portfolio, we have allocations to managers who specialize in software, in China A shares, in activism in small cap Japanese stocks, in international companies that have been backed by private equity companies, or in credit markets, in specialist credit areas like distressed debt, which is a really niche and specialist area, which we think has some very attractive characteristics. And so the really important thing to understand about the external managers that feature in our portfolio, there's about 12 in total, is that each of them is an expert in a very defined area. They're able to deliver returns through skill and their own actions. And importantly, they're doing different things to one another. So they work really well as building blocks within a portfolio because they don't have very high correlation to one another. When you put them together, you do get a degree of risk diversification, but you don't dilute returns. You're not just layering on more of the same risks. And by the way, the sorts of managers we allocate to operate off the beaten path. And so they're also not giving you more of the same risks that you might find in other investment trusts or in markets more generally. Most of the big household name investments do not feature in these managers' portfolios. So the bar is very high for these managers. They're all operating either in equity strategies or credit, so very fundamental, very long-term, and we think they're absolute experts in their respective fields. Second part of what we do, we call special investments. And probably 5 to 8 times in a given year, we are given the opportunity to invest alongside some of the world's best investors in their highest conviction ideas. It might be a co-investment in a particular public equity, might be a credit situation, or it might be a thematic opportunity. And normally we can do that on pretty attractive terms. And again, these are opportunities that just don't come on the radar screen of most of our peer group. So we have 3 criteria for a special investment. It must come from a trusted source. Whoever brings us an idea must have something to lose as well as something to gain by doing so. We have very ambitious return requirements for special investments. So we must think we can make at least 20% annualized returns out of these opportunities. And we must feel that we can monetize them within 3 years or less. So as I said a few moments ago, although we're very long-term and patient, we don't want to lock our shareholders' money up or our clients' money up for multi-year periods. So 3 year for us is the cutoff for these. And then the third part of our portfolio we call direct investments. And this is a very carefully curated selection of direct investments in public equities, all listed in the developed markets. We have very clear quality and growth criteria around the stocks that we invest in. But again, they tend to be very differentiated and an eclectic collection of stocks. So you won't find any Magnificent Seven stocks in our direct investments part of the portfolio. And that's around the last two bits, special investments and direct investments, are each around 15% of the portfolio. And then we have a little bit of cash as well.
So I think, Dan, we could probably do a podcast on each one of these three, but I've got a couple of questions on each of them.
Yeah.
So the external manager strategy, highly diverse. I want to get into the thinking behind it in terms of the allocation process there, because you mentioned there you're looking for competent managers, but how much of the allocation process is top down compared to bottom up? I mean, is it solely looking at the manager, the skills of the manager, and thinking, you know, this is a good manager, and you may have a couple of different, or maybe 2, 3 or more different external managers within the same asset class? Do you have much of a management oversight in terms of where the actual cash is going, or is that sort of a backseat to the actual manager and what they're doing on the grounds?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in a couple of ways, if I may. So first of all, we would describe ourselves as being macro aware, but we're not macro driven. So we don't think we're very good at timing markets. We know that we can't predict the future. And to answer your first question, we will never use a manager in order to express or populate a top-down view that we might have on whether America is going to outperform the rest of the world, or value is going to outperform growth, or a particular sector is going to do well or badly. So the bottom-up dominates everything else. If we don't think a manager is a fantastic manager and can generate returns over time through their own skill in a particular area, we won't invest, however strongly we may or may not feel about a top-down opportunity. Now, having said that, we've found over time that the best opportunities often exist in areas that are overlooked or unloved, or to put it another way, where the probability of future outcomes is not very well reflected in today's prices. That's certainly a good starting point to look for a really good manager. And it gives you a nice entry point in a manager that does specialize in a particular area. So, really, for the last 18 months, almost since we started managing Magedi, we have found more and more of the best opportunities outside of the US and outside of the household name, mega cap quality tech stocks that up until quite recently had done so well. So to give you a couple of examples, we have an allocation to a manager called Helicon, who are based here in London. They also have offices in Milan, and the manager, Federico Riggio, and his team, highly experienced. They specialize in finding value situations, high quality businesses that we sometimes describe as being sheep in wolf's clothing. These are good quality companies that the market thinks might have something wrong with them, or there's a reason why they're out of favor. But fundamentally, in terms of the cash flow and earnings these companies generate, they're actually very high quality, safe, resilient businesses that can be bought at attractive valuations. And Helicon has been a tremendous contributor to our returns over time through fishing for good ideas in unfashionable areas. One of the areas we feel particularly strongly about at the moment, or we're excited about at the moment, is China. Again, China has been considered uninvestable from the perspective of many allocators recently. We've known a manager for some time called Perseverance, based in mainland China, that has whose manager has an extraordinary ability to find really good, high-quality companies that most Western allocators have never heard of, that can be bought at a deep discount to equivalent companies elsewhere in the world. And of course, at a time when China itself is front and center from a political and economic standpoint, one of the things we really like is that that has enabled someone like Perseverance to buy great quality stocks at very low valuations. Now, it so happens that we think the market's underestimating the potential for China to stimulate its economy, that they're really determined to stabilize things, particularly in the face of the trade war, that there's something like $1.7 trillion that's been committed to that stimulus. The stock market is a really important policy tool in terms of encouraging more consumption and for money to come out of savings and into productive assets. And so we think this is a fund that we're invested in because we really, really like the manager's stock picking abilities, but we think that headwinds are probably going to turn into tailwinds. And that means that we can earn supernormal returns for an extended period from that manager. So that's a long-winded way of saying the bottom up overrides everything else, but we do like investing with managers in areas that are a bit unpopular and may become a bit more fashionable.
You mentioned there about a nice entry points and being, of course, macro aware. So, you know, what would you say that goes into the timing of entry and exits of external managers? And maybe if you give a bit of insight into how long you typically hold on to an investment in any one manager.
Yeah. So the timing of the entry point is entirely opportunity driven, but we spend more of our research time looking at areas that, yeah, we think people are going to be paying more attention to. And the lead time is quite long. I mean, we do a lot of really deep, intensive proprietary work on these managers, as with all of our investments. So very often our team of analysts will spend, you know, weeks, if not months, researching a particular manager before we actually decide to invest. And accordingly, our turnover is really low. So in an ideal world, we wouldn't change anything in any given year. And the main reasons that we would exit a manager investment would either be because the area in which they operate is no longer receptive to their skill set. It goes without saying, if a manager breaches a risk limit or something fundamentally changes in terms of people leaving or the business, then that's a reason to move on. And then, of course, it's sometimes you just find something that you like more. But our intention is to be extremely long term. And many of the managers we're with today, we've been with since we started our firm 12 years ago. And in many cases, I was invested with them in my previous firm for 10 years before that. So we have really, really long-term relationships. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're able to access some of this exceptional talent. We do have a reputation for being demanding but patient capital.
Thank you. So move on now, if we may, to the special investments. And I'm looking here at the fact sheet, Dan, and you've got a list of the holdings there, which are Project Uranium, Project Wrigley, Project Senior. What do these look like? What sits behind these investments? And are you able to share what sits behind there? It's obviously using code names there. What do these investments look like?
Yes, so I apologise for the cloak and dagger code names. The reasons that we use those, other than the fact that my team likes being creative in coming up with cryptic ideas for the names themselves, is that quite often when we're first invited to make a special investment, we are under confidentiality agreements. And that is sometimes because the manager whose idea it is, that their own stake in a business or their intentions are not publicly known. So very occasionally we will have price sensitive information, or the very fact that, for example, an activist is going to take a stake in a company might deem price sensitive. And so much as we would like to be completely transparent, we're not permitted to do so. But as soon as we're allowed to do so, we disclose the underlying investments to our clients. By the way, we're really transparent as a general observation. It's people are entitled to know what we're doing with their money, and we give very good disclosure on the underlying investments on the website in our quarterly letters. So you mentioned a couple of those. I'll just touch on them briefly. So Project Wrigley is a co-investment in a publicly listed restaurant company called Portillo's. And that was brought to us by a group that we have known for a long time based on the West Coast of America called Engaged Capital. And Engaged specialize in taking stakes in high quality businesses that have not fulfilled their potential in the public markets, either because of a management misstep or strategic misdirection or something else that's overhung the stock, which Engage think is very fixable. So one of our successful previous co-investments was in another restaurant business that Engage took a stake in called Shake Shack. And they were instrumental behind a big turnaround in the fortunes of Shake Shack. And having returned capital to us in that situation, they proposed a new co-investment in Portillo's. Portillo's is a Chicago-based quick service restaurant, has a very loyal local following, but it has not been as profitable as it might have been because management had not implemented some of the basic disciplines around quick service restaurants, so centralized cost control, the unit size of their restaurants was very large. They hadn't fully monetized the potential of having drive-through. They didn't have a breakfast menu. And the management had a pretty patchy record when it came to rolling out the successful Chicago format in other parts of the country. So Engage have got involved. They've brought in cost consultants, strategic advisors who now have board representation. And they believe that they can double the level of profitability, the four-wall profitability within each of these restaurants. And although it's still very early days for the format, and you know, over the short term, the US consumer looks like it's under a bit of pressure, they still believe there's enormous upside in that particular situation. So that's one. Project Senior, you mentioned, is a activist investment in a much larger company in the States, CVS Health Corp. That's brought to us by a very well-known healthcare investor in the States called Larry Robbins, who runs a firm called Glenview. He specializes in payors and providers, the kind of institutions surrounding the US healthcare industry. In a nutshell, he believes there's huge potential for profitability to improve at CVS, in particular as they show more discipline around the pricing of their big health insurance business. There's been a replacement of management. Larry Robbins has got onto the board himself. Stock's up quite meaningfully this year, but he still thinks has a long way to go. And the other one you mentioned, Project Uranium, that title's not very cryptic. That's an investment in the public in publicly listed uranium stocks, brought to us by a chap called Mike Alkin, who's based in New York now. We first got to know him through his former employer based in Dallas. And Alkin, if you Google him or look him up online, he's now become something of a kind of guru in the uranium space. When we first invested with him 7 or 8 years ago, no one had heard of Mike. And his thesis is essentially that uranium, which has now become an important part of the clean energy transition movement, that uranium supply is nowhere near enough to meet demand, and that there's a structural deficit, which means contract prices for uranium are going to have to go up a lot, and nuclear fuel buyers at power generation companies haven't really worked this out yet, and when they do so, they're going to have to pay much higher prices for the uranium itself, and that's going to lead to meaningful price increases in the equities of the companies who produce and mine this important commodity. So they're all a little bit different. They are they're all esoteric. We've done other really interesting things in litigation finance quite recently, in credit markets. So we had a good special investment last year in the senior non-preferred bonds of Metro Bank, the troubled UK bank, which went through a restructuring. And there's just so much coming through the pipeline now because of the dislocations going on in markets. We've got more to look at than we can really pick over at any given point in time. So we're quite excited about the potential for that part of the portfolio.
I mean, that is a truly fascinating category of investment there. You know, and as I said at the beginning, you know, there's investments there that people just can't get exposure to. And going back to your macro aware, there's some really good themes within there as well. So that's
Can I just touch on that point for a second, Jonathan? Because you raised something then that I think is possibly the most important thing we could talk about on this podcast, which is we believe that the world has changed, that since COVID, we have moved from a regime that really began in 2009, a financial crisis, a regime of falling interest rates in which markets went up, leverage was pretty cheap, dispersion within markets was quite low. Everything moved up and down, mostly up together with a couple of notable episodes. And the most important thing for investors who wanted to generate good absolute returns was just to stay invested. I should also say the US outperformed everything else over that period, and the dollar went up a lot over that period. And we think that regime came to an end a couple of years ago. And that we're now in a world of structurally higher interest rates. There's going to be less leverage. There's going to be more volatility. And there is going to be greater dispersion in the fortunes of winners and losers within every asset class, sector, and region. And so an investor is no longer going to be able to depend on tailwinds from rising markets. And in order to survive and thrive, they're going to have to find really compelling, differentiated bottom-up opportunities. And that's what we do. And it's my understanding that's why the board of Magedi chose us as their manager, that they believe we've got the skills and capabilities to find, as you've just heard, these very eclectic individual opportunities, each one of which can work independently of the macro conditions. But when you put them all together, you get a really nice portfolio effect. You're not putting all of your eggs in one basket. So with apologies for being a little bit existential for a moment, it's not just interesting that we come across these sorts of investments. I think it's absolutely essential. And I just think if we speak, hopefully in 5 or 10 years time, one will find a lot of the things that work very well over the last 10 or 15 years haven't actually worked that well. But for the very best active managers, and we're not apologists for active management as an industry, but the very best active managers have got an absolutely golden opportunity ahead of them.
I think it's a very good point that you make there, Dan. Over the last 10 years or so, it's very easy to be swept up in the US tech stocks and think that that's going to be the way forward. But markets always move in cycles, and portfolios like this will have something in it which offers investors the upside for the next cycle that we see. Yeah. And some of those may also be in the direct investment component of the portfolio here. So this is the last of the three that we're going to touch on. Again, you know, the big theme of diversity throughout this, and just looking at the individual holdings here, you know, Computer Center, Weir Group, there's a GlobalX ETF on copper miners. What's the thinking here? Is this still the same bottom-up approach? You know, how much is the macro coming into this? And you know, I think the question that I have here, you know, in terms of the team, do you have a separate set of people that are looking at the individual direct investments compared to maybe looking at the special investments and the external managers? You know, what does that look like? How does the management process you know, come up with these ideas?
So it's one team and we're all generalists, and it's really important that everything in the portfolio is fungible, and so we don't feel obliged to populate any particular category. But definitely different members of the team have different skill and expertise, and two of my colleagues spend most of their time on the direct investments side of things. The COPEX idea, that's a bit of an oddity. We put it in the direct investments category because we hold a direct investment in a collection of copper stocks, but it is somewhere between a special investment and a direct investment in practice. The short version on that one is, again, we think there's a big supply-demand imbalance within copper, that over the medium term, there's just not enough of the stuff to satisfy the demand that's going to come from not just traditional industrial sources, but the clean energy transition and incrementally China. That people are very bearish short-term on the demand side of things, but we think the commodity itself and the equities that produce it are very cheap. So on that one, we don't really want to take a big specific view on an individual company and the mining risk that comes with that. So we've done it through an ETF that owns most of the major copper producing stocks. All of the other direct investments we hold are very idiosyncratic and specific. So you mentioned Computer Center, which we think is a truly great British company whose purpose, its reason for existence, is to act as a kind of middleman between large corporations and their IT and infrastructure procurement teams and the vendors of IT equipment. And Computer Center adds value to both sides. It acts like an outsourced sales force for the IT vendors and for the big companies who need to invest in hardware and software. Computer Center has economies of scale, buying power, and can actually integrate now a lot of these companies' own systems and way of doing things within their own business to make themselves indispensable. It's a really cheap stock, very profitable, very cash generative. And we think this is one of those things. IT spending is just one of those things you can postpone for a certain period, but not indefinitely. A couple of other interesting names that spring to mind in the portfolio. We don't have many US stocks now. We're down to two, amazingly. But one of the ones we do like is a company called KBR. And KBR is another great business that has two main divisions. One of them is environmental technologies, but the other one is government services. So it performs a whole load of logistics, infrastructure, and testing functions for governments, including the US government and military, the Australian government and military, NASA. And so this is a stock that we first bought a couple of years ago, performed very well, and it got clobbered shortly after the election, when Elon Musk was appointed as head of Doge, because the market decided it's going to be completely in the crosshairs of government cost cutting. We think those fears are misplaced, that KBR has very long-term contracts, incredibly sticky business because a lot of the work they do is very high security. We suspect that NASA is not going to be the first thing that Musk goes after for obvious reasons. And our earnings expectations for the company have actually gone up, not down. They've announced good new business wins, and that's a stock on 11, 12 times next year's earnings. And its earnings are growing at 10, 12%. So we really like that one. And the latest thing we've added to the portfolio is a European auto company called Stabilus. Again, conforms to the pattern I told you about. It's an unfashionable area. People are very worried about the auto cycle generally. Stabilus specializes in making valves and automated compression equipment. So, for example, when you press that button on the boot of your car and the boot opens up, that Stabilus has very dominant market share in making that piece of equipment. And we think that there's a good chance that as destocking works its way through the system, that demand will return for autos. They're just as well positioned for electric vehicles as they are for combustion engine vehicles. It's got pricing power, margins can improve, demand can return, and this is a stock on a single digit PE where expectations are very low. So yeah, again, these are not household name investments, and we think each of them has got potential to deliver. I think our we model base case upside for our direct investment portfolio of about 50% at present. So if we get there over 3 years, that'll make for a really nice return.
Would you say that you're value investors when it comes to the direct investments?
Well, there's a long answer and a short answer to that question. I'll give you the short answer, which is yes. We are value investors, full stop. But my definition of a value investor is someone who seeks to buy an asset at a discount to its intrinsic value, i.e. the net present value of the future cash flows that will accrue to an owner. And I do think that growth is an important component of value. Your margin of safety, to coin another value investor's favorite phrase, is much greater if you are investing in a high quality business whose revenues and earnings are going to grow over time than if you are going to invest in a low quality business that might look really cheap, but you don't know whether it's actually going to be there in 2 or 3 years from now. So I would say, yes, we're value investors, but we're not deep value investors. And that's why we've always felt very comfortable adhering to general principles around ESG and sustainability. We just don't want to invest in companies or sectors that there are kind of questions as to whether they will even exist in a few years from now.
Thank you. So I've got a number of questions here, Dan, and this is sort of looking at the bigger picture now, just to frame the discussion so far. So you did mention the closed-ended structure at the beginning, and you know the transition for the strategy. So why would you say, going back to that point, that this strategy is particularly well suited to a closed-ended structure?
I think from a portfolio manager's point of view, the closed-end structure is great because it enables us to be patient whilst being responsible. So we can invest in things with a 2 or 3 year time horizon and don't have to worry about dealing with inflows and outflows on a daily or weekly basis. But as I said, also very importantly, we're not investing in anything deeply, deeply illiquid. So we think the closed end structure is really well suited to the investment approach. But I also think the investment approach is very well suited to the closed end structure. And what I mean by that is, since I ran an investment trust a while ago in my previous role, I think the whole sector has changed dramatically. And 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, wealth managers and individuals could not get access to really best-in-class equity strategies, let's say, through UCITS funds. They didn't exist. Well, they do now. And I think for a modern-day investment trust to survive and thrive, and ultimately that gets reflected in its discount to NAV, you have to be offering shareholders something that they can't get anywhere else, that they can't get responsibly through other structures. And there's no way you could do what we do within a UCITS structure or a daily dealing fund, because we would be running a big mismatch between the liquidity we offer investors and the things we invest in, which would be grossly irresponsible. So I think the two sit alongside one another very well, that we can take full advantage of the structure, but the structure can take full advantage for us by giving shareholders something that they couldn't get elsewhere. And I think and hope that's reflected in the fact that since when we were announced as the new manager of Majedi in October 2022, it was at the discount to NAV was in the high 20s, and it's come in to kind of 6-7% at present, which I think is something of a vote of confidence in the approach at a time when obviously a lot of other trusts have seen their discounts go the other way.
Indeed. Just as a quick point, Dan, what was the performance been of the trust since you took over 2 years ago?
So since we took over, the NAV is up 15 and a bit percent. We've paid out several dividends, and the share price performance is up well over 20.
Thank you. So given what we've discussed today, and this is a question for the listeners, and I'm really framing our discussion about why they should consider Majedi. And you know, the question is, you know, why should they consider the Majedi Investments Trust as part of their portfolio?
I would give a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
So the first is the contextual one that I touched on a minute ago, which is, it is my view that if you want a really good chance of compounding your wealth at an attractive rate above inflation over the next 5 or 10 years, you're probably going to have to look outside many of the areas that have served that purpose for you over the last 10 or even 20 years, that I don't think conventional return sources are going to get you there at a time when markets look pretty expensive and there's a lot to worry about in the world. And the indices themselves are very concentrated and lopsided and focused on some of the most expensive investments. So the first thing is, I think we know where to look to find good ideas at a time when historically productive sources of return are less likely to get you there. The second is that I think we bring something different to a portfolio. So we will not give shareholders any duplication. They will not find the things we own elsewhere. So it's a source of diversification in a portfolio context. The third is that we really care about the share price. We are incentivized on market cap, not NAV. We have our own money invested in the trust. The family, who for many years has been the cornerstone investor in Majedi, is a very supportive shareholder, and they said it was essential for our interest to be aligned with theirs. So I think this alignment point is also really, really important, that our interests coincide with shareholders. It's one of the reasons we just paid off a debenture. Majedi's had a debenture for 25 odd years, which matured at the end of March, and we pay that off because we just don't see any need to borrow money in order to invest in our strategy. And that'll save shareholders about 100 basis points a year alone. So this alignment point is really important too. I would say those are the three main reasons.
Thank you. So to finish off now, Dan, last question here. When we're looking at the year ahead, what do you see as the main factors that are going to be driving returns for the trust?
Well, we've done well to get this far, and we haven't mentioned Donald Trump, haven't we? I'm afraid that noise is not going to go away. So I think we all expected Trump to bring with him a certain amount of volatility, but I don't think any of us had expected the level of upheaval or onslaught of policy announcements that we've seen in recent weeks. And it's quite obvious to us that Trump 2.0 cares a lot less about equity markets than Trump 1.0. But it does seem that he has to care ultimately about the bond markets and the currency markets. and hopefully that will be a restraining factor on his policy behavior, as well as I think the fact that there are midterm elections that a few Republicans might get a bit anxious about 18 months from now. The whole tariff thing is really challenging for investors to contend with because, first of all, it's very hard to quantify the impact that the tariffs themselves will have on companies and economies. Second, it's very hard to quantify what the second order impacts are. Even if the tariffs are repealed or modified, it's very hard to know what the real hit is to consumer confidence and capital expenditure plans. And then thirdly, they could change tomorrow. So I think we're going to be in for a lot of volatility. And our challenge and our opportunity is to take advantage of that rather than fall victim to it. One final point on that note, which is I think currency is going to be a really important variable over the year ahead. That we've all become accustomed to the idea, certainly over the last decade or so, that the US dollar normally goes up. And I think that has to be brought into question. That since 2009, the net international investment position, that is the amount of capital that foreign countries have invested in America, less the amount that America has invested in foreign countries. In 2009, that number was negative $2.3 trillion. As of the end of this year, it was negative $23 trillion. And so it's simply not the case that the last 10 years have been bad for America. America has benefited enormously from capital inflows, and the dollar has gone up 20-something percent over that same period. I think there's a very good chance that we've reached, as you said, at the very beginning of the conversation, Jonathan, there's a very good chance that the cycle has come to an end, that many of the best investment opportunities lie outside of America, and the dollar is not necessarily a one-way bet. And that's really important for investment trust shareholders, because if you are a sterling-based investment trust and you were invested in assets that are denominated in another currency, unhedged, you're effectively taking two bets. You're betting that the investment goes up, and you're betting that the currency in which it's denominated does not go down. Now, I know there are mitigating factors and we're very aware of those, but ultimately we want to stand or fall. We want our results to be a function of the three things I've talked to you about today, the external managers, the special investments, and the direct investments. We do not want currency to derail that whole story. So with the exception of special investments, which are in a variety of currencies, we will normally hedge any non-sterling exposure back into sterling. So shareholders can think of Megetti as a sterling asset. And I would not be surprised at all if at the end of this calendar year, there were some very divergent performance outcomes from investment trusts that did or didn't manage or mitigate their currency risk.
That is a very important point that you make there, because there are a lot of investment trusts that are investing in various different assets in different currencies, and having that hedge there if we do see some big swings in the underlying currencies, that can wipe out any gains in the underlying assets in the local currency. And you know, that is something to be mindful of. That's a really good point there, Dan. Thank you. So just as a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Megetti Investments website. You'll be able to download their latest fact sheet, also be able to get a little bit more information about those three categories of investments that Dan has so kindly and comprehensively outlined today. So Dan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us. Pleasure talking to you.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.